And we're recording. Guys, good morning. Sunday, the 15th of August. Matt Haycock's here for your weekly roundup, but it's not just 1 week this week. We've actually got 2 weeks to do in one. Because any of you guys who are ardent followers of this will know that I was a naughty boy and I didn't record last week. That is because, you know, I was about to say that is because and have a legitimate excuse. I've got no excuse whatsoever, other than I had Harley with me for a few days last week and a bit of drinking and a bit of partying. And I kind of felt as well, I didn't have too much to talk about. So I used it all as an excuse and didn't do it, but I apologise. But I've got to tell you the truth because I don't want you guys to think I'm immune. A lack of discipline as well. Sometimes I'm a naughty boy. I'm just having my Christ, don't know what that is. Having my breakfast juice. I have a juice every morning here. I eat so much bloody food. I try and at least just have liquid before about 1-2 in the afternoon. My chef just makes me a surprise every day. I never ask him what he's put in it. And sometimes it's probably best I don't know. Anyway, tell you what, actually, talking, this is probably the first time I've filmed early-ish morning ever since I recorded these. I normally end up getting them done a bit later in the day. And whilst I'm certainly not here to dish out health and fitness advice, I am far too shit at exercising. And far too bad at eating terrible but tasty food to give you guys any hints and tips. One thing I will tell you is I went to bed last night about 10 o'clock, half past 10, and I hadn't had any food since about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I tell you, I must have had the best sleep I've had all bloody summer. Once a year, always normally around October time, I go to what I call my fat camp, and I go and do about 10 days, normally in Portugal. And I'll do 5 days of a liquid diet, followed by 5 days of a kind of a 800 calorie a day diet. It's tough, don't get me wrong, it's tough. Don't have oodles of energy for exercising and stuff, but I go there. I can normally lose 10 pounds, 12 pounds, you know, that's 5 or 6 kilos for you international people. Can normally lose that much, do some exercise, do a lot of, you know, massage and chilling out and stuff. But the reason for telling you this is what I always find is whilst I don't do my best workouts ever there because I'm just exhausted from lack of food and lack of energy, what I do is I sleep so good. Because what they always talk about is, you know, how eating late or kind of eating before you go to bed puts so much stress on your stomach, and it's almost like, you know, like when your head's whirling around and you can't sleep. You know, when you've had a lot of food in your stomach, that's kind of whirling around and you can't sleep either. And I know some people say, oh, well, when I've got a full stomach, I fall immediately to sleep. You may fall immediately to sleep, but I promise you, you'll have a shit sleep. I'll tell you that from me, who for about 350 nights of the year eats and drinks wine just before I go to bed. But felt so good. So if you're about to tune out of this video and you take nothing else from it, try and have a night today where you eat less, or rather eat more, but just eat it earlier. You'll feel so good. Anyway, let's get on with business. Let's go with making money, talking money, telling you what I've done good and bad and different this week. Well, these last 2 weeks, having a look through my notes, we're going to be talking a little bit about crypto. Somebody messaged me actually and asked for some thoughts on crypto. We're going to be talking about not overcomplicating things in business. We are going to talk about someone who contacted me for their business and did a pretty shit job of it, to be honest. I think I'll tell you why. We're going to talk about these videos and what business I may get from them and why you guys should look at doing this kind of stuff too. I'm going to talk about a couple of people I've hired this week. We're going to talk about one of my favourite subjects to talk about, certainly not one of my favourite subjects to be involved in, but we're going to talk about bank accounts that have been locked. We're going to talk about training Harley on the e-foil and why, with the right mentor and the right motivation, you can do anything. We're going to talk about turning leads into sales on Instagram. We're going to talk, you know, we're going to talk about so much stuff. Honestly, you'll either be happy or sad that I've not recorded for a week, because I've got so much to talk about today. So let's just get on with it. Starting from the top, crypto. I know this is going to be something a lot of you guys want to talk about a lot, and it's going to be something that some of you don't want to hear another word about. I'm going to keep my crypto advice pretty simple. Anyone who follows me regularly will know that I have an interest in two particular coins, Bitcoin and Ethereum. Now, I'm going to talk to you very globally about crypto here, because I'm not into giving specific tips on anything, on any individual share, on any individual coin, and I only ever talk about the things that I know and understand. But what I will tell you is I've made mistakes on coins and shares too lately. And the reason I've made those mistakes is because I've deviated from my plan and done things I shouldn't have done. The problem with any of these cryptos, any of these shares, is too many of you guys are buying stuff you've got absolutely no idea what you're talking about. You know, your pal in the pub or your mate on Instagram said, buy whatever, buy Cardano, buy Dogecoin, buy Bitcoin, you know, whatever coin it is, it doesn't matter. And you're buying this stuff on nothing more than, you know, a tip from someone who you don't even know if they know what they're talking about. And honestly, I know it almost like sounds flippant to say it, but you may as well stick your money on red or black, or even a number on roulette, or pick a horse or whatever, because you know, whether or not you win or lose has got nothing to do with what you know. If you wanted to get into crypto, listen, I was late to the game, very late to the game. I didn't buy my first coins until like the 6th of February this year, 6th or 7th of February this year. And I didn't do that until then for two reasons. One, I didn't get involved in the beginning when everybody else was, not because I was clever. Obviously, in hindsight, I was stupid. I've bought much higher than everybody else. But the reason I didn't get involved back then is because I didn't have the time, or didn't decide to want to make the time to learn and understand about it. And when all my mates were buying, and they say, oh, we've got to buy this, you know, we're buying Bitcoin, it's going up, I took the view that, you know, when your taxi driver is telling you to buy Bitcoin, when your waiter in your restaurant's telling you to buy Bitcoin, it isn't the time to be buying it. Now, the fact it went up has got nothing to do with whether or not those people knew what they were talking about, because they absolutely didn't. And it's gone up and gone down and gone up and gone down. But at the beginning of this year, I decided it was really time to start learning about it, and spent probably 6 or 7 weeks of solid time, books, podcasts, audio books, YouTube, you know, learning everything I could about Bitcoin and then Ethereum. And then at that point, I felt I knew what I was talking about, not in great, great, great detail, but certainly enough to start risking my own cash. And I started to invest some money. And I think you always learn quicker when you've got real money on the line. And then as I started to buy, I would then continue to learn and continue to buy. And as of today, 99% of my portfolio is 99% of my portfolio is in Ethereum and in Bitcoin, because I'm buying those two coins with a very long-term view, with a view that Bitcoin will be something that I probably never sell, if I want to have some liquidity in the future that I can borrow against it, but in the same way that I would buy stocks and shares, like index funds, with a view to holding them forever, or with the same way that people, you know, may buy some, you know, precious metal like gold with a view of holding it forever. That is how I'm looking at Bitcoin and Ethereum, with a similar view. But both of these coins for me have got solid organic traction. I've got a defined use case. I've got strong liquidity. I've got many other features that, you know, that attract me to them. when we talk about the other coins, you know, I'm not going to say, I can't say that some of these might not become the next Bitcoin or some aren't going to go up over the coming days, weeks, and months. The problem is I haven't got a clue why. And I did make mistakes too. I want to tell you these because I'm glad I made these mistakes because it's brought me down to earth again. You know, when I was buying the Bitcoin, and you know, I've done quite well on it. I mean, I've got a substantial six-figure holding in Bitcoin and Ethereum, pushing on seven figures, and you know, it's gone up well. And also over the course of this year, so there's a fly there. Over the course of this year, I've had two or three quite big touches on some shares. Again, you know, a combined almost seven-figure return on a couple of shares. And it made me a bit reckless, it made me a bit cocky, and I've then ended up buying you know, three or four of the shares and coins, not huge positions relative to, you know, relative to my overall portfolio, but you know, not insignificant amounts of money. I bought 10 grand in Dogecoin, I bought 10 grand in Litecoin, 10 grand in XRP. I bought 25 grand's worth of shares in Cineworld because for no other reason than the fact I decided that when you know, they're very low off their peak, and when the world reopens and when people start going back to the cinema again, they'll go up again. And I tell you this because you're collectively, you know, those 30, what have I got, 40, 50 grand's worth of shares, 50, 60 grand's worth of shares and coins, I've probably dropped from about 60 grand to about 20 grand. Now, look, in the grand scheme of my portfolio, it's neither here nor there, but it's still enough to wake me up and realise that I was an idiot on those things and I should never have bought them because I didn't understand anything about them. I bought this coin because my mate was doing it, and I bought this share because I had a loose feeling around it. And I'm glad I've lost that money, honestly. Take those words in. I am glad I've lost that money because it was enough to wake me up, but not enough to really hurt me. And if I hadn't have done it then, I would have got carried away dabbling on some of this crap I don't understand. It could have been a lot worse in the future. So it's been a little bit of a reset and brought me back down to earth. It's important that you guys listen and learn from that. You know, don't ring me and ask, not ring me, DM me, whatever. Don't message me and ask me for a tip on something, because, you know, any tips I've got, they're not really tips. I'll tell you my strategy. I always talk to you about my strategies on these videos, on these podcasts and stuff. But if you're asking me without you knowing anything about it, you should not be doing it. Absolutely shouldn't be doing it. So that is my crypto commentary for the day. Talking about things that you should and shouldn't be doing. I'm always conscious of keeping all these stories real, but trying to redact the parties in them as much as possible. But had a conversation over the last week or so with my partner of mine on a business that I got involved with recently. Where this business has been fraught with problems, and unfortunately, prior to my involvement, you know, my partner on it when he was on his own has, you know, I think for want of a better word, been fucked by everybody. I mean, anybody who's come near that business has taken advantage of him. And you know, we were talking about this and trading emails on this recently, and you know, and he obviously feels very badly done to. Because you know, he feels he's outsourced these areas of responsibility, let's say, to people who have not performed on their tasks and let him down greatly. But you know, I take a very different view on that, and this is, you know, this is something I've been telling him over the last week, which, you know, I think he takes on board and agrees with, that ultimately, as a business owner, you are 100% responsible for everything that goes on in that business. Now, if you outsource something to a third party and they fuck it up, or they steal from you, or they let you down, or whatever it may be, whilst they may have done it, it's your fault, it's your responsibility to have understood enough to have been able to employ the right people for that task, or to have understood enough to pull back the reins on them when they were veering off track whilst doing that task. Now, too often, I speak to other business owners, or you know, hear from people where they'll always say, "Well, I've outsourced that task. That's not for me." That and it's normally accounting. Accounting's a massive one. Often business owners will abstain from any kind of financial commentary on the business whatsoever, and just say, "I'll talk to my accountant or talk to my finance director." Very often, it's with marketing. I don't get involved in marketing, I leave that to the marketing team, or whatever comment that may be. Or when you have a legal case on, you pass it over to your lawyer and you just leave them to crack on with it. Now, what I'm advocating here is not that you become a jack of all trades and a master of none, because we all need to have certain skills that we excel in. But I think to be a competent and successful business owner, you have to have enough knowledge in every single area of business that is relevant to you. So accounting, maybe that's property, maybe that's litigation, maybe it's construction, it's certainly got to be marketing and sales, potentially it's operations. All of these different areas you have to have enough knowledge in that you can both do the task to a certain degree, but certainly have enough knowledge so that you can speak to third parties and understand what you need to understand when you're buying from them, and understand enough so that when they are pulling the wool over your eyes, you can correct that. We could pick many, many granular examples, but like, I don't know, take my bit in my businesses, SEO, pay-per-click, litigation, accounting. I don't have enough specific knowledge of any of those tasks to be able to replace any of the people. I can't replace my accountants, I can't replace my property, I can't replace my litigators, I can't replace my pay-per-click or SEO staff. But believe me, I've got enough knowledge to have pretty much any conversation with those guys, to know if they are doing their job in the right way, to know if they're taking the piss, to know if they're being too slow. I can apply this theory to many, many areas of my business, and you'll have that similar ones in yours as well. But what is absolutely not acceptable is to say that you don't get involved in that area and you leave it to somebody else, because anything you leave to someone else, you will probably get fucked on. Maybe not on day one, maybe not every time, but you will get taken advantage of, or you will get let down if you don't know enough about that to get involved with it. And you may not like that area of subject or whatever. And my only suggestion, other than putting the effort in to have the knowledge, my only suggestion, if you really are unwilling or unable to learn yourself, is to maybe contemplate having a business partner or multiple business partners who have skills in those areas, where you can share the equity risk, so that you know that those people are going to be fighting your corner. If you're a finance guy and you've got no interest in sales and marketing, or if you're a sales and marketing guy and you've got no interest or ability in finance, maybe you need to partner up with someone so that you can have complementary skill sets and both have a vested interest in something. But other than that, I guarantee you, during your career, you're going to get fucked. So take that on board. It's a couple of negatives to get us off with now, but very, very important ones. What else? So let's talk about something a bit more fun and more positive. Harley. My daughter Harley. Those of you who are new to watching this or listening to this or don't know me, I have a 15-year-old, or she'll be 15 next week or the week after. 15-year-old daughter, and she's been coming out to visit me over in France over the last 2 or 3 months while I've been living on the boat. And I've got some great toys on the boat, some great water toys, jet skis, flyboards, e-foils, paddle boards, sea bobs, all the tackle. And I've been loving my new favourite toy is the e-foil. For those of you who don't know, an e-foil is basically like a small surfboard with a fin on the bottom and an electric motor. So that when the electric motor is spinning and you're on it, it starts to rise out of the water. So you're literally almost like being on a hoverboard floating on the water. I spent about 10 weeks this summer trying to be able to do it. I can do it now. I'm not going to sound good, but I can certainly do it enough to enjoy it. I can stand up, I can foil a little bit, I can mess around on my knees as well as being stood up, so I love it. But I'm being desperate to get Harley to do it. And I've found myself being a bit of a tutor on the boat for anyone else who wants to kind of come on and do it. And it's funny, so Harley, she has decided, probably it's her teenage rebellion against me, that she doesn't like water sports. And I'm like, come on, of course you like water sports, you know, who doesn't like water sports? But she fights me and says, oh, I don't want to go on the jet ski, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do the other. And I've been desperate to get to learn the e-foil, because I know that if she did it, or if she does it, she'll have a great time on there. And she was refusing. Anyway, she's after a horse saddle. I need some new saddle for a horse, some ridiculously expensive horse saddle. So I says to her, what if I got you the horse saddle when you've stood up on the e-foil and done a 360 degree journey around the boat? And she was like, yeah, 100%, I'll do it now. I'll do it right now. Get me in that water. So we were having this conversation in bed, so we didn't actually do it right there. And then we did it the next day, get her in the water the next day. And I jumped in there with her, and it took probably 10 minutes for me to get her stood up, flying a bit, stood up. She actually didn't make it all the way around the boat. And then we got distracted and didn't get a chance to do it again. But within 10 minutes of having not done it before, not wanted to do it, and then lying down on the board, you know, a potentially complicated thing, she was up and at it. And I'll tell you this story because I just think it's really important to, you know, to know that on anything, you know, with the right motivation and the right mentor, there pretty much isn't anything you can't do. Now whether you're listening to this for yourself or for your kids or for your staff, just think about those two points, you know, motivation and mentor. What can that do to achieve it? Obviously, Harley's motivation may have been a bit too grand. I think getting paid in a fancy horse saddle to do a fun activity like e-foiling, I'm sure many of you may think of as excessive, and I probably don't disagree with you. But it's serves to prove a point anyway, that, you know, everybody has their motivation. And in terms of the mentor comment, I say that because I've been on this E4 now for 10 weeks, and I've had to fight through and find what works and what doesn't work for myself. And now if I look at anyone on there, even if I can't do it as well as many, many other people, I know all the basics and all the fundamentals of what you need to do to be able to do it, where your body weight needs to be, what's the right speed, what's the right time to get up or to not get up. So I can very, very much reduce the learning curve for somebody who's never done it before. And I can't tell you how true this is. You know, like sometimes I'll sit on the back of the boat, if I'm having a drink and I can't be bothered, you know, teaching somebody else, I see them go in the water with their friends for the first time, and they'll go on it, and they'll be messing around in there for an hour, for 2 hours, and not even get up onto their knees because they don't understand the fundamentals. If I go and take 2 minutes, literally just 2 minutes, and say, move your left leg there, move your right arm there, immediately, like that, everything changes for them. Because you've got to have someone who can help you, who's been there, who's walked the path before you, who's suffered the problems along the way and can share their experiences. So motivation and mentor. Think about those two things for anything that you or people that are important to you in some way, shape or form are suffering from. What else is on here? so much on here. I'm just actually looking at the time. 25 minutes in already, and we've got so much to talk about. Little quickie. I did a bit of filming for Channel 4 this week, for Channel 5 this week. They contacted me a couple of weeks ago to film a documentary they're doing about people who've moved abroad and live and work abroad. And they asked me to film the Monaco episode for them. So they came on the boat, did a bit of filming on the boat. We had a few questions, went to a great restaurant I love called Sass Cafe in Monaco, and did a bit of questions and answers there. Just talking about, you know, the attraction of being abroad and, you know, life out of the UK, etc., etc. Reason to tell you this, not specifically about that programme. But I get contacted quite often now, you know, relatively often anyway, to do some kind of media opportunity. Again, for those of you that don't know me, or those of you that do know me, you'll have known I've done, you know, Rich House, Poor House, did a little bit of something on Real Housewives of Cheshire, filmed, you know, on other people's podcasts, on other people's YouTubes. And listen, none of these things are obviously Hollywood A-list type activities. But the reason I tell you is people often say, well, why are you doing that? You know, why do you do these things? And I have only two answers for all this always. One is I'll say yes to pretty much anything because I want to have experiences and stories to be able to talk about. And normally doing this kind of stuff is good fun. You know, it gives me some good stories to talk about over dinner and to tell people in the future. But the other thing is, you know, just the exposure that these opportunities can create for me, because, you know, they always introduce me to a new audience. You know, whether going on someone's podcast introduces me to their audience, or whether, you know, being on Channel 5 for Rich House, Poor House introduces me to a different national audience, or whatever it may be. If people don't know about me, they can't interact with me. When people know about me, they can do business with me. They can give me more opportunities. So that is why I always say yes to pretty much everything. And that's why if you guys ever get the chance to do stuff as well, don't overthink it. Just get on with it. You might think that, you know, you're shy, or you don't want to be in this, you don't want to be the other, don't want to be on the other. Get over it, and get over it as quickly as you can, because the more people know about you, the more opportunities that are going to come your way. It really, really is that simple. What else can we talk about? Friction. Let's talk about frictionless business. How do you allow your customers to pay you? I use a driver here in Cannes. He's not my driver, but, you know, he's a guy who's got a nice car, and he drives me around if I need something for me or for my friends. I use him for two reasons. Reason number one is he's a great guy, and he's always on time, and he's always there to pick me or my friends up when I need them. But there's many, many drivers who are going to tick that box. The real clinching point why I always use this guy is because he allows me to pay him using PayPal. Now, you may think that is an unusual thing for me to say, or wasn't what you're expecting me to say. But the reason I love PayPal is because I never really have many euros cash on me. I can go to the cash machine, but it's a pain in the arse, or I'm limited to getting a couple hundred quid a day out, or whatever it may be. And sometimes some of these driving journeys are 200 euros here, 300 euros there. You know, we had to pick someone up from Italy, which cost 600 euros. So I just simply don't have the cash and can't be bothered to go to the bank to get it. So it makes my life very easy if I can use PayPal. I've probably got four or five other drivers I could ring here, but none of them will take PayPal. And I always tell, and, you know, I've got a couple of nail girls and beauticians and stuff I use here. And again, one of them takes PayPal, the others don't. But I have this conversation with them. Look, this isn't me specifically advocating for PayPal. But what I'm saying is you've got to have options. You've got to have options for your customers, and make doing business as frictionless as possible. Because none of these things are complicated for you nowadays, right? For you to open a PayPal account will probably take you 3 or 4 minutes. For you to open a Stripe account and be able to take credit cards with 3 or 4 minutes. And you know, I'm trying to think of other methods of payments, you know, maybe taking crypto or whatever, but you know, you can probably do that, you know, using a Stripe or using a PayPal or something now. And you may, you know, it may not suit you initially to think, oh, well, I want the cash, or I just want them to make a bank transfer to me. But you are locking yourself out of doing business if you don't provide some of these options to other people. When taking this driver, honestly, I must spend at least £1,500 a month with them. £1,500, €1,500, whatever. And I promise you that that main reason is because of the PayPal. If it, you know, if it wasn't for that, there'd be two or three other drivers who'd probably get a bit of regular business from me as well. But he has it all because he removes the friction and he gives me what I want. So take that story and put it in your own context. You know, what are you doing to, well, what could you do to make it easier for you people to do business with you? And payment options is obviously a big thing on Laurizia and Accent, our fashion businesses. You know, we have implemented Klarna on those. If you guys know Klarna is another payment option that allows people to either pay buy now and pay later, or to pay in three equal installments. Because you know, we sell high value items that many people can't afford to pay for in one go. And offering them those credit terms is the difference between having a sale and not having a sale. And when it comes to online trade, online e-com, there are so many different payment options because different cultures also like to shop in different ways. You know, some people still like cash, other people might want to use a money order or whatever, you know. And whilst it may sound inconvenient to you at first, there aren't many of these things where there isn't already some kind of provider and some kind of infrastructure in place that will allow you to do what, you know, to allow you to do what you need to do there. So check that out. And also, talking about frictionless business, a recruitment guy got in touch with me recently. A guy who'd done some very specific recruitment on a finance position for me, and we were arguing over, well, I'll tell you the exact numbers. He wanted, we'd done a job with him in the past on a 17% fee, very specific piece of recruitment for a 17% fee, and at the time I'd wanted 15%, and they wouldn't agree to it, and I took the view, you know what, I can't be bothered arguing because it was more important at the time for me to get the role. And they did get the role for me, so I can't complain. But they now want to do some more recruiting, and we actually do need some roles filling. But I'm less desperate now than I was the time before, so I'm prepared to stand on and wait till I accept 15%. Now, believe me, they will accept 15%. If you're going to do it for 17, you're going to do it for 15. You're not going to walk away from the business, not when you know I can perform, and that I do perform and that I pay on time. Why would you walk away from that business? And I said to the guy, get 15% signed off and we'll start immediately. He spent the next 2 weeks waffling me that he's trying to get his boss to agree to it, then coming back and saying, look, my boss has agreed, however, we'd like to do this. And he came back with this really complicated structure saying, if you give us three positions and you pay some of the money up front and you do this, that and the other, will drop from 17% to 15%. And to us, it was almost such a complicated structure, I couldn't even bother reading it. I've gone back to the guy and said, listen, mate, what are you messing around at? You've wasted 10 days, 2 weeks here where we could have been doing business. Just accept the 15%. Any position you hire, you'll get the 15% on, but I'm not doing any of this weird and wonderful shit that you want to do. Anyway, he came back immediately and said, yes, fine, agreed. Let's crack on and we'll accept the 15%. But why put that friction in place? Why do that fucking dance, right? Just, you know, I'm not saying here don't negotiate and fight your corner when something's valid. But when it's not valid, remove the friction, get on and do the business and make the money as quick as you can. So that is that. Talking about people, somebody got in touch with me recently, wanted me to use him as a travel agent. I have a fantastic travel agent in place. Not to say that he may not be a fantastic travel agent, but I do all my travel through two different people, commercial travel through a fantastic lady, and private jets through a fantastic guy. And are they always the best, cheapest price in town? Probably not. Sometimes certainly not. But there's never much in it, you know, a few percent here and there. But what's more important to me than the money is the service and the loyalty and the fact that these people never let me down. That when there is trouble, because there's always trouble when you travel, you know, flights get cancelled, weather causes issues, hotels let you down, whatever it may be. When there is trouble, these people are contactable at any hour of the day or night or the weekend and fix my problems for me. So I'm not going to leave them. It's that simple. However, right, that doesn't mean never ever contact me to try and get business from me, because things always change. And this guy got in touch and he basically said, "Look, I follow you on Instagram. I know you do a lot of travel. I'm a great travel guy. You should give me a try." Words to that effect, anyway. And I replied to him to say, "Look, I've got a couple of great relationships that I already work with. I'm very loyal to them. You know, if I was already using you, you wouldn't like it if I was chopping and changing with other people, would you? So I'm gonna, you know, continue to give my business and loyalty to these people, but thanks for getting in touch," kind of thing. And he replies to me saying, "Yeah, no problem, I understand. If anyone else could do with a travel agent, please put me in touch with them." Now, listen, I'll tell you a story because I want you to contextualize that whole thing. I mean, what a shit fucking response. I've told the guy that I'm very loyal to the people I use because they're very good. And all he can say is, "No problem, but if you know anyone else, put me in touch with them." Well, why the fuck am I going to put him in touch with anyone else? If my mates ask me for a recommendation, I'm going to give them the recommendation of the person that I'm already using, not somebody who I've never used before. That's point number one. But the most important thing is, he's just been lazy, because nothing normally lasts forever. And one of two things is going to happen with my travel, like it happens in all of the kind of buying areas of my business. I'm either going to grow to a point where I may have outgrown a smaller operator, or I'm going to grow to the point where I need one or two operators on board, or someone's going to let me down and it's going to give the chance for somebody else to get in. And somebody needs to be there waiting in the wings for when that happens, or if that happens. And it may never happen, or it may take months, if not years, to happen. But you know what? That's what business is about. It's about building, you know, that's what sales is about. You've got to build your pipeline. You've got to put the effort in. And, you know, the payoff may be a long way down the line, but if you correctly prospect, then that payoff will be worthwhile. And listen, anyone who knows me knows that if you want to supply me travel, you will get big dough out of me. You know, I spend multiple five figures a month on, you know, sometimes into six, on travel for me, my staff and businesses, and my friends around me. So it's really worth putting the effort in. But if you're not going to do that, you're never going to get the chance, you know, to expect to contact me on the right day in the future and just say, "Oh, you know, give me some business." It's never, ever, ever going to happen. I look at some of the things where I've put long-term effort in, and what, you know, one of the biggest ones is with my investors. You know, when I try and bring on new investors, at least 60-70% of the time, you know, I'm talking to people who have already got other places that they're happy to commit their capital to. So when I contact them, doing business with me is not top of their agenda. And I can spend, I tell you what, one relationship, I spent nearly two years of calling, of emailing, and of taking this guy to lunch before we actually did any business. But believe me, now we're doing that business, it has paid for itself 100 times over. But I was prepared to do that, A, because I had prospected right and knew that that person was capable of giving me the kind of quantities of business I wanted, and B, because I had the belief in my own abilities that, you know, one day I would get this guy over the line, and when I do get him over the line, it will pay dividends. And if you guys don't have that belief in yourself, and aren't prepared to put the effort in, and find a different line of business, please. What else can I tell you about on here? Just have a little look through. Instagram. And a lot of you guys try and use Instagram, social media, Facebook, etc., to do your marketing with. One of our businesses, one of our fashion businesses that we've been putting a lot of effort of late into rebranding and doing new photography and creating new online and social presences for, has it's just starting to kind of come together, just starting to grow. But one of the kind of permanent conversations, permanent debates we have internally is kind of how to generate business from it. And what I'm always telling my team, and which, you know, what you guys need to really think about as well, is don't get hung up on Instagram likes, Instagram comments, etc. Obviously, scale is important to a degree, because the more people who are in your audience, the more potential people you've got to take business from. But what really matters is the engagement from those people and the relationships that you've got with them. And if you've got, for example, 500 followers on an Instagram page, but then you've got 6 or 7 DMs in your mailbox from people who sent you a message and 7 or 8 comments on a post, right? Those 5 or 6 DMs, those 7 or 8 comments are infinitely more important than those aggregate 500 followers. And as soon as these people have put their hand up to make contact with you, to interact with you, to engage with you in some way, shape or form, they have just become your hot prospects. They have just become your leads. And those are the people that you need to be jumping on and decide, and working out how you take them from being a lead to being a customer. And what I see far too often going on is people do posts to try and attract attention, etc., you know, to try and get the likes, to try and get, you know, to maybe try and get some comments or some shares. But then when people start engaging with them, you know, when people start dropping into their DMs, they just get ignored. And, you know, these people then just go and do another post and another post. What the fuck are you doing these posts for? You're doing these posts to generate business, right? So when you've got people who are putting their hand up and saying, hey, I like you, hey, look at me, hey, talk to me, then you need to be interacting with those people immediately. Otherwise, don't bother posting anything ever, because these people, you know, they're not going to sell to themselves. And, you know, and they need you to take them by the hand and get them over the line. And ultimately, that is 100 times more important than how many likes you get, or how funky, you know, your imagery is, or whether or not something's gone viral. Look, all of these things may help towards getting more interaction from people, but when you get that interaction, that's all that matters. How do you take that interaction and convert it? A couple more quickies, or two, one quickie and then a book, and then we'll go. I know a lot of you guys use external agencies for marketing and PR. And if you watched last week's, well, 2 weeks ago now, but if you watched this 2 weeks ago, I talked about marketing and how the most important person to do your marketing is you. And that outsourcing marketing, when you don't understand your brand, when you don't understand marketing principles, is anywhere between dangerous and pointless. Now, I have some guys doing some PR work for me, and we were working this week on writing an opinion piece to go in a magazine or a newspaper, an opinion piece regarding coronavirus. And this piece was, the way we've created this piece is, I did an interview with one of their journalists, they wrote it up, and then they sent it to me to sign off. Now look, when I got it, I'm sure many of you guys, if you read it, you'd think, oh, that's a nice piece. But when I read it, I just knew that if I'd have written that piece, I would have done things in a different order. I would have used different words. I would have used a different tone of voice. Now, just to be clear, I'm not saying that the guy who's written it has done it bad. He absolutely hasn't. But he's not done it as me. And I probably spent, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes rejigging that piece around to send back to them. They've done a few more tweaks and sent it back to me, and we've now finally signed it off. But I tell you that because, you know, I know a lot of you guys want to grow your online brand, want to build your brand, want to grow your visibility. And, you know, I've made the mistake in the past of handing things over two external agencies and leaving that whole thing with the external agency. And invariably, the brand that comes back or the vibe that comes back is so far removed from me that it isn't me. Now, honestly, no matter how little time you think you've got, you need to make the time to control and own your brand. Because even little tweaks here and there make all the difference, because the people that know you will know you. But if you don't really know me and you read an opinion piece or you read a quote from me or something, you may like that. And it may engage you with me a little bit. But for the people who really know me, when they read this stuff, they will know it's not me. And you know, I used to have a lady who did some posting for me on Instagram back in the day, posting various quotes and things. And the people that knew me, the people that did business with me, would read these quotes and they'd send a picture of them or WhatsApp them to me and go like, ha, 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 ha. And not laughing, not because that quote's bad in isolation, but they just know it's not the kind of way I'd say something. It's not my tone of voice. It's not my belief. And the key, the key to growing your brand is authenticity and consistency. And that's never going to happen if you give ownership of it to somebody else. So I'm not saying you can't have people to help you, but you've got to own it, you've got to control it. I think that is about it for what we're going to talk about this week. I finally finished the book, finally finished Invent and Wonder, which is the collected writings of Jeff Bezos. Anyone who's been listening to me or following these weekly roundups over the last couple of months will know that I've been trying to read a bit more and more over this summer, and particularly over the last few weeks I've been reading Jeff Bezos related stuff. I've never read much of him, but I've never read anything of him before. Obviously I know who he is, and I just happened to be in Dubai in a bookstore and there was just a pile of books in the sale, and they were all just Jeff Bezos related, so I just bought a load of them. So I've read a few of them now, and all of the principles that are in one tend to be in the other, maybe with a slightly different way of saying it. But what I've really found fascinating with Jeff is the way, Amazon, I don't know how big it is. If it's not the biggest company in the world, it's definitely the top two or three or top 10 or something. I mean, the scale of the company is enormous. But what really interests me is how Jeff appears to run it with such a new start entrepreneurial mindset for a business which is already trading at such scale. He seems to be a man with great compassion and empathy and understanding, and it's been really good to read him. But one thing that I thought I'd share with you guys is about decision making, because I know a lot of you guys struggle with decision making. You get nervous, you'll procrastinate over decisions, and things will keep you up at night. Invariably, most of the decisions that you make probably are insignificant and could be made in seconds. But I guess until you develop that confidence and that decision-making muscle, you'll never overcome it. But one thing Jeff talks about, and just to put this into context, right? Because when you're running a business like Amazon, a business at that scale, the decisions that you make, can have a multi-million, if not billion, impact, and impact on tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. But what Jeff talks about is decisions that are two-way doors or decisions that are one-way doors. And a one-way door is a decision that once made, there's no turning back. That is a major, major decision that cannot be undone. But he basically refers to the fact that most decisions in life, most decisions in business are two-way doors, and that once you've stepped through them, if things go wrong or things don't exactly get to plan, you can actually turn around and step back through the door again. Maybe there's going to be some kind of cost, whether that's financial or whatever, but they're not going to be, it's not going to be a catastrophic cost, and it's not going to kill the business. And he basically talks all about the fact that when things are two-way doors, when the decisions are two-way doors, they're made quickly and actively and by small teams, and that he'll delegate a lot of that authority and responsibility down the ranks. And it's only really when something's a one-way door that they start to get a lot more analytical, and that he needs to be involved in that process. I just thought it was it's just very very what's the word eye-opening or refreshing to hear a business owner, a CEO of a business that size, talk in those kind of terms. Because it's quite often we talk about the difference between a small business being able to be nimble and a big business not being nimble, because they have to have so many layers of reporting and decision making, and it takes them so long to make decisions, so long to turn that ship, that they can get snapped at all the time by young hungry entrepreneurs. But Jeff proves that that doesn't need to be the case, and that look, if a business the size of Amazon can make decisions that quickly and that swiftly and that nimbly, then you can too. So that is it for me for this week. Like I say, 2 weeks in one, 50 minutes we've been talking. So if you have listened to this whole 50 minutes, drop me a comment, drop me a DM, and tell me that you listen to me all day. Hope you like these. As always, if you do enjoy them, please leave me a like. If you're watching this on YouTube, subscribe to it, pretty please. If you're listening to this on iTunes or Spotify or however you listen to your podcast, leave me a review. It'll only take you 15 or 20 seconds. It means the world to me. Helps me obviously continue to get people seeing these podcasts, listening to these podcasts. And obviously everything I do is always for free. And I will always continue to share my learnings and experiences with you, and I hope it benefits you guys. I know I get a lot of positive messages from people who implement some of the stuff I talk about. So please, in return, if you could leave me a comment or give me a share or tell your mates about me, I would be very, very appreciative. But other than that, that's me, Matt Haycox, signing out on Sunday the 15th of August. I look forward to chatting again next week, which I guess will be the 22nd. See you soon. Bye-bye.